More Than a Game, The GAA and Where It's Going. It's a new book out by Michael Moynihan, the Irish Examiner journalist, and it follows up on his book, GAA Economics, with a look at the financial realities and the future for the organisation that's a large part of parishes all over Ireland. It's a very interesting read. It deals with money, payments to managers, the building of stadiums, the role of players at club and intercounty level, and the future for the organisation. I spoke to him and first of all talked to him about the book and about the future for the GAA. Okay, Michael, listen, thanks for joining me and look, congratulations on the book. Before we start, you have to understand you're talking to the people at Kerry now. So everything is fine with the GAA. We've won the All-Ireland. The money's not a problem. So why are you bothering us with this story?
All is right with the world. I'm glad. Yes. I'm glad you bring glad tidings to all my friends in Kerry. Actually, Kerry's a very good place to start with the book. Because when I was writing it, Kerry hadn't won the All-Ireland. So it's an interesting juxtaposition now with themselves in Tipperary, for instance, because, again, without wanting to bring a rain cloud over people in Kerry. Obviously, in Kerry and Tipperary, there are significant kind of infrastructural projects in the pipeline in the big stadia in those counties. And I suppose a couple of people have made the point to me since then that obviously those counties are going to have to raise a lot of funds, but winning the All-Ireland is a great entree because you can obviously say to a financial institution or to some private benefactor, look, we're doing the right stuff on the field of play. We're winning the All-Ireland. You can trust us to do that. You guys have the financial expertise, so we'll partner with you guys, but you can trust us that we are experts in our specific field of endeavour. So it's actually a good time to discuss this kind of stuff because Kerry and Tipperary are riding high at the moment, for which, you know, we're all duly grateful, I suppose.
indeed. And look, there's multiple different aspects to the money discussion you talk about in the book in terms of the future of the organisation, the ethos of the organisation. There's the club side of it, there's the county side of it. But on the inter-county side of it, is there a bit of an arms race going on in terms of who spends what, the amount of money that's spent on the inter-county setup within counties that want to be successful? Is there an unfairness there on some counties that just don't have the money to compete?
Yeah, I mean, and this obviously became a real topic of discussion when Dublin were really on top for quite a few years, and there was a lot of talk of financial doping, etc. I think it's worth teasing out two slightly different things. First of all, there is the kind of acknowledged funding that's being allocated or being spent on preparing teams. That's teams 43, 44 million officially last year. And I think most people would think of that as being pretty unsustainable because you're talking about money that's going out and nothing really is coming back. It's not as if, you know, to pull in other sports, it's not as if, you know, you can sell a player to Liverpool and maybe recoup some money and, you know, that'll keep you going. So that's one thing. But of course, the other big one is the fact that there is so much money being spent unofficially, by which I mean, you know, you and I and taxpayers everywhere are being defrauded of hundreds of thousands in tax revenue because of the under-the-counter payments within the GAA. And to complicate matters further, as you kind of alluded to, that's okay in places like Dublin or Cork or even Kerry, which is quite big, right? But the county situation means that a county like Leitrim is trying to compete with a county like Dublin. And I think anytime we get caught with an American or an English, say, sports journalist, you try and explain what the GAA is, the county situation, I think that's where their brains break a little bit because that's manifestly unfair. And the fact that, you know, very small counties or sparsely populated counties have had success in the past, I think is a bit misleading because the more the games become professional, the more advantages accrue to the counties which have greater resources. So I think while it is an arms race, it's very seriously biased towards, you know, the counties with the big arsenals or the big bank accounts, I suppose, to be more accurate.
Yeah. Talk to me then, Michael, about what you said in relation to that element of the shadow economy going on in GAA, the payment of the manager under the counter or the payment of the club manager under the counter across the board. You say it's widespread. It's been going on for a long time. Everybody knows about it. It's wrong. And yet it still happens.
Again, it's really difficult to find a comparison or an analogy with this. I was actually on Radio Nogaret a couple of weeks ago, and the segment on before me was some archive of Charlie Haughey speaking. I think it was a centenary of his birth. And what I said on Radio Nogaret is there's a slight similarity here in the sense that when Charlie Haughey was really bestriding the scene like Glasgow, people were suspicious about where his money was coming from. But it was almost an open secret that there had to be something that didn't add up. What was going on?
Yeah.
And that is happening with the GAA. You're looking around saying, hang on a second. I know that money is being paid to managers under the counter. No manager is admitting to that. So there's a complete disconnect. What was really striking writing the book, nobody pushed back and said, you know, you're exaggerating, or that's not really an issue. And, you know, master payments. All of them admitted it. Admitted it existed, not admitted to taking money.
Yes. Yes.
All of them said, yeah, that is a huge problem and it's very difficult to deal with. But there was no sense whatsoever that I was exaggerating for effect or that I was dramatising. If anything, since the book came out, a couple of people have been in touch and I think I woefully underrepresented the significance of the amounts at play. They are truly
really
eye-watering.
Astronomical sums.
Well, the way it was put to me was by one person with direct experience. I have to be very careful how we phrase this. Was that this is not a kind of generous expenses. This is more than a living wage being paid, and sometimes by clubs, which baffles me. I've long been a proponent of if you're a county board, you're old enough and big enough to know better. So if you do want to spaff away hundreds of thousands of euro, that's your own lookout. But I think it is very dangerous for clubs, which are proportionately smaller, to be spending 20, 30, 40, 50 thousand euro on a coach or a coaching package when there is very little evidence that you are getting anything in return. I'm not even mentioning value for money, but that doesn't exist in this world, right? But that there's nothing coming back in terms of upskilling coaches within the club. Maybe the guy comes in and can justify it because, look, he'll train the minor team or he'll give the under-16s good habits, etc. There's nothing. There are people who are on the circuit who are bouncing around making a lot of money. And the stories that I was told and which I have no reason to disbelieve were extraordinary. My favourite was a highly regarded coach in the Munster area. We'll be no more specific than that. Yeah. Coaching a team, getting 300 euros a night, approached by another club. And he said, yes, he could accommodate the second club. But the first club trained him, say, Mondays and Wednesdays. So the other club would have to train Tuesdays and Thursdays. So he could pocket, you know, his 1,200 euro unbeknownst to the taxman every week.
My God, that's huge money. Two different clubs and all under the table. All this wasn't going through bank accounts. This isn't on the record. This is cash in hand. Cash is king.
You might remember some 12 months ago, there was a shiver ran down the spine of every treasurer in the GAA when the revenue were going to take an interest.
I do. Now, I mentioned the story on Kerry Today that morning because it stood out as, whoa, something new going on here. The revenue might be taking a look.
Exactly. Now, the way it turned out, I think they were focused on one or two counties in particular, large sums of money and maybe, you know, accountancy practices that needed to be shaken up. But certainly more than one contributor said, this could possibly be the watershed moment when you really kind of set the revenue on clubs and counties. But by the same token, you can't run an organisation where the rule breakers are being kind of kept in line by the revenue commissioners. That's just kind of a Wild West situation. It's also that was very dangerous for the GAA because what you were really saying was you've allowed the situation to become so bad that we're going to involve the revenue commissioners. Now, the natural consequence of that is that they will have a look at the literal drawer in the clubhouse full of paper receipts and handwritten amounts and say, we're going to impose a really rigid, stringent financial structure. The natural consequence of that then is that the person who's an accountant living in the village and who's happy to help out once or twice a week and maybe help with the accounts in the year is going to say, hey, the last thing I want to be doing in my spare time is facing two or three unsmiling representatives of the revenue in a small room at the end of the year. I'm out of here. I think what has protected the GAA is the fact that if you did that for GAA clubs, you would have to do it for soccer and rugby clubs. You would also have to do it for you know, the Tidy Towns Committee, the
Scout Troop.
So everybody will be facing that. And I think the revenue will have enough sense to know the social capital being generated by all these organisations outweighs whatever would come in terms of revenue. But
that's not
a card I would be relying on playing all the time if I were the GAA. I think it's never an example is going to be made of somebody, some club or some county to try and encourage others to toe the line.
Right. And with that in mind, there's been attempts and talks, and presidents of the past have, at least once they're a term, they have said, well, we're going to have to do something about this. And Jarlath Burns went a bit further and suggested some sort of formalised stipend situation. Yeah. Is that a slow-moving glacier to address this problem or issue?
To be fair to him, he is trying to grasp a nettle, and instead of saying, you know, we'll turn the tables upside down, you can't even find the table to turn upside down. I think, unfortunately, if you introduce payment, you introduce employment law. And straight away, you're talking about a can of worms then. Like, Gerry O'Sullivan is the Kerry manager, and he does very well. And say, another county, say, we'll bring him in, we'll get him to train our county. But hang on a second, Gerry has some formal arrangement under the stipend with the Kerry County Board. Now, are they going to hold you to your contract? Can the other county say, you know, freedom of trade and freedom of movement and employment?
If you're sacked from a job, you have to be paid off.
Exactly.
So, right, we had you on this, you're not doing well, you're gone.
Yes. What about
Here's
your
X amount of money.
Coach? What about your physical trainer? What about your selectors? What about the sponsors? What if the team is not going well and the sponsors say, look, our name is being dragged through the dirt. We'd like to get this other guy in as manager. Is the county board going to say, no, we backed Gerry, so you'll have to butt out? That it becomes very, very delicate. And again, you'd be worried that there'd be an equivalent of the Bosman ruling. There'd be the O'Sullivan ruling allowing you to go and coach Dublin to another All-Ireland title, for which everyone would have to pay then for decades afterwards in the Eagle Field.
Yeah. So look, on that front of it, that's one of the nettles that yet to be grasped. But the wider context of that, and it's a related discussion, and I found it when it comes to media coverage of the GAA and the money generated by same, things are changing and they're changing fast. They've even changed since you published the book terms of what the GAA are deciding to do now. The club game is now being monetized. Forget the intercounty game, the club game. People are paying €12.99 or £13 or €14 for a game, or paying £150 a year. It's a brilliant service for a lot of people who can't make games, so there is a demand out there for it. But this is new territory now, isn't it, again, for money in the GAA?
Yeah, and I wonder, is this kind of an intermediate step? You know, we had, you know, the traditional, you know, big organisation, RTE generally, and now we have this kind of intermediate, say, club or the various streaming services. And I wonder, is the end game kind of Kerry GATV, Cork GATV, where you have sole control over the club championships in your own county in terms of broadcast? Maybe there's a different model with the inter-county game. But it's interesting because Darryl Kinnaird made a very, very interesting point about this in the book. And he teased this out as only Darryl can, pointing out that there was a time very recently that the GAA's motto was nothing beats being there. And that was a very good card for the GAA to play when the Olympics or the World Cup is on. It's like, okay, that's on the telly and that's great, but you know, you can just walk down the road or you can drive 5 minutes and you can see some of the best athletes in Ireland, and that's great. But since then, that has been replaced rather subtly by Where We All Belong. Now, Where We All Belong is also a very inclusive, very welcoming and a very good slogan. But it's not quite the same thing. And you would have to ask, does Where We All Belong mean I can belong if I pay £12 to watch on my laptop? Whereas if you go back to, you know, nothing beats being there, I'm present. I'm part of the club. I can help participate. I can play or coach or, you know, do something in administration. I'm just curious about the messaging there, because you're distancing yourself a little bit from the GAA experience. And in comparison with other sports, the GAA is very much dependent on involvement at all levels and in all forms. So I would be a little bit worried that, okay, there's money being generated by the, you know, small scale streaming, but in the medium term, are we distancing people from the GAA experience? Because once You know, someone comfortable at home, it can be very difficult to get
to shift them off the coach. Yeah.
To be on a committee, to be a selector, to bring the kids out even. And especially when I would see that as being an intermediate step towards more closely controlled, say, county board partnerships or maybe provincial council partnerships, which will take over the broadcasting of the games.
Yeah, yeah. And look, with that in mind, does that raise the question then, the old story of professionalism in the GAA? Like, you're talking about the inter-county scene, first of all, and the players getting paid. Has that, do you think that has got the capacity to capsize the organisation? Would it ever happen? And even that now, is there any kind of legitimacy to a club player saying, well, hold on a second, how much money was generated by the game I played in last weekend? And what am I actually getting from it?
So I suppose, to be fair, I would have to say that, you know, as representative of the population, as any other group, you know, your inter-county player is well aware of that, of the economic situation in the country. Things are good for most people nowadays. When I wrote G-Economics a few years back, I was writing that banks were literally closing down the country. So how you would sustain 32 senior football squads and maybe a dozen senior hurling squads, with some counties having to double up, I wasn't sure how that would happen. And I still can't see that. To be fair, you would have to say the GAA is professional, but there is no pay for play. Like, I'm sure you would have noticed in media coverage, you know, when a very good player retires, the first thing they said is, oh, the ultimate professional, the way he prepared and diet and recovery, etc.
Yeah.
When we're talking about managers, we often hear, oh, he's a new deal or a one-year extension, etc. So that acknowledgement is there that it's elite amateurism or professionalism in all but one aspect, and that's pay for play. And to be honest, I mean, I can't see how that would work, in the sense that when rugby faced a similar crossroads in the mid-90s in Ireland, where the championship, the obvious part is there was an external market that was obviously going to help drive that, particularly England and France, which are vast commercial markets, and in terms of TV deals, were able to drive that, etc. And at the end of the day, as the man said, there are still only four professional rugby clubs in Ireland. There was a time when one of them had to kind of take to the streets and ensure its own survival. So I can't see the model where that would work. I know Tom Parsons said to me for the book, and as I said since, that, you know, enabling players in terms of a slightly enlarged grant, for instance, to maintain
tax arrangements, other things like that.
Helpful. But of course, the obvious retort to that is that, Tom, at what point is that professionalism? At what point is that pay for play? Are we getting really into the semantics then? A bit like, you know, you're paying a manager a stipend rather than a wage. Are you getting into semantics where you're facilitating someone's tax arrangements, whereas a more creative accountant or less creative might say you're being paid?
Yeah, 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 that's an interesting one. Michael, look, finally on this, the wider context of infrastructure in the GAA, and the amount of money it costs to build stadiums and stands. You mentioned there Fitzgerald Stadium. There's a bid to try and get money in to buy that, to redevelop that. The government we look to, fundraising is happening, the diaspora involved here as well. But the model to me seems increasingly like, from a government point of view, similar to other European countries in particular, it's the municipal stadium is the one that will be funded by the government. The basketball hall, the badminton club, the walking group, the active sports membership organization, whatever it is, and the soccer, rugby, football pitches in that complex that all have to be used together. Is that something the GAA is ready for? Because we've seen, and in your own county, bad examples of money, way too much money being spent on white elephant stadiums just because they were there all through history. Is that model over?
Yeah, no better example than the place about a mile and a half down the road for me here.
Yeah.
Very interesting to hear people from the Munster Council and Croke Park and various counties for the book say, you know, municipal partnership is the way to go. And municipal partnership, it's one step into state involvement, obviously, and partnership. Makes absolute sense to do what you're saying, to create one kind of monster campus or a slightly larger campus with, you know, running tracks, walking track, you know, gym, etc., a pitch that can be altered, etc., for rugby, soccer, and so on and so forth. I mean, to me, looking at a place like Kerry, to me, the great nettle would be, do you really need two stadiums? You know, because we're here in Cork, and a very obvious solution to our problems in Cork would be selling Park Erie for housing.
Yes.
Now, that would create logistical problems and fixture and scheduling problems, but it would get Cork GAA out of a huge hole. To me, and again, I'm not saying this to be provocative, does Kerry really need two stadiums of that size? Far be it for me to say one rather than the other. I would see maybe, is there more room for expansion around Fitzgerald Stadium than there is in Tralee? You know, but if you were to get rid of one, and if you were to invest that money cleverly, as you say, instead of having a massive stadium, which might be filled twice a year or three times a year, and maybe not always for Gaelic Games purposes, you would have a really superb bespoke consumer experience. And it was really interesting for me to hear so many people say, look, we have to give people more of an experience than you're just coming for the game. That has to be around your comfort, the wheelchair access, the food offering, ease of egress and ingress, all of these things. And to me, maybe focusing on something slightly smaller, but that's more luxurious, that's more inviting to people, and that compares with other sports offering would be better. But certainly, the municipal/state partnership has to come.
Yeah, a place that's never empty is the idea. Yeah. It's used at all times, different times of the week. It's used, the money goes to value, because you have different clubs, different organisations using it from Monday to Sunday.
Yeah, and another thing people need to realise, and it's explained in the book, stadiums don't really generate money. Croke Park is an outlier because it has so many concerts, it's got such a conferencing business, etc. But as Tom Ryan, the Director General of GAA, said to me, if you go to Pier Stadium, if you go to, you know, Markovitch Park, if you go to Parky Thieve, these places, they're empty. They're not, as he said, they're not meant to be generating money. They're not meant to be cash cows. But those and the centres of excellence, which, by the way, is another drain.
Another whole ball game.
People don't realise. People don't realise about a centre of excellence. You know, okay, you might get some of the five-a-side pitches out for rent, something, but that's not really going to generate money for you. And you're not in a situation where, for instance, down the road, is that Ringmahon Rangers have a sell-on of a couple of million from Kevin Kelleher. Okay, that justifies maybe a lot of the work they've done. Great community club, and they'll put that money to good use. That's not happening in Gaelic Games. The ultimate success for you is to have someone on the All-Ireland winning team, someone who's done really well. But there isn't a cash value, there isn't a revenue stream coming back from that. And people need to realise that about stadiums and centres of excellence. Because I think there can be a sense, certainly in countries which don't have a bespoke centre of excellence, say, all our problems will be solved when we have this.
By a centre of excellence, yeah.
Whereas, as more than one contributor said, if you go to every county in Ireland, many of them have a kind of a third level institution, but every one of them has, you know, kind of the predominant, usually a diocesan seminary, the predominant school or college in that county. And the obvious thing is to partner up with that, to invest some money, maybe add on another pitch or a couple of dressing rooms or a gym, etc., instead of going for a greenfield site, which will cost you millions, which you'll never make any money from. So again, you know, using a small bit of humility and a small bit of cutting your cloth would serve the GAA very well.
Okay, Michael, fascinating stuff. It's a great read, and thanks, William, for taking time to talk to me this morning about it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Morning Game, it's out now in all good and bad bookstores. Well worth a read in looking at the organisation, where it's going, the whole pay side of it, and all of this thing. If you've a view on it, and lots of you do, then get in touch with us on the programme this morning.